All right, so we'll go ahead. I'm sorry, that was an unofficial roll call. We'll call this meeting to order and do an official roll call for the record.
Joe Sparks?
Here.
Claudia Cope?
Yes.
Pip Speezy?
Yes.
Evelyn Binsgord?
Here.
Sarah Batiste? Deb Jepson? Mary Alice Short? Debbie Gonzalez?
Here.
Kayla Hansen? Nicole Plutkus?
Sent.
Debbie Coxon?
Here.
Gary Newman?
Here.
Jennifer Elhard? Ryan Keel? Ashley Monroe?
Here.
Kim Eam?
I'm here.
Robin Winant?
Here.
John Clendenin? Jennifer Youngberg?
Here.
Walter Wheeler?
Here.
Brad Crick?
Here.
And Richard Machida?
Here.
Is there anybody whose name I didn't call? Oh, I missed Kat Williams and Jeanette Altman.
Here.
Anyone else?
All right, thank you everyone for joining us today. We'll go ahead then with item 1B, approval of the agenda for today's meeting.
So
number
moved.
Number 234.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any changes, questions, or concerns? All right, then hearing none, all those in favor of the today's agenda, 234, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Hearing none, thank you. The next item is the minutes for meeting number 233.
I move to approve.
We'll move to the amended. Add absent two present.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the minutes for 233. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second.
I will comment. There was a couple of tiny items on page two that are just kind of minor typos. Happy to pass those on. I don't see.
Okay.
Word two and capitalizing another one. But
okay. Any other changes? All right, then hearing none, all those in favor of the approving the minutes for 233 as amended, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Hearing none, we have minutes for 233. Let's pause for a moment. Chancellor Rogers, would you like to be moved up?
Thank you.
Would you like to
be?
At this point, we have at 9 o'clock is our scheduled time for public comment. Is there anyone online for public comment? Is there anyone in the room for public comment? Hearing none, we'll close public comment, and I'm going to adjust the agenda. Chancellor Rogers has joined us up here, and I'll give him the floor.
Thank you, and happy holidays to all. Appreciate, as always, the opportunity to meet with staff council. Wanted to go over just a couple of items, the primary one being status of the budget. I met with the Fairbanks delegation yesterday to go over where we are on the FY14 budget request, soliciting their support for some additions to what we got from the governor. The governor's budget is very much a bare-bones budget for the university this year. What he's going in with on the capital side is the core commitment that he made 4 years ago for a base level of deferred maintenance funding at $37.5 million a year for university system-wide. Of that, UAF gets about just a little over $20 million. We had asked for, in addition to that, $75 million to take care of some of the backlog. The 37 is almost enough to keep us even, but doesn't cover any of the backlog. And included in the $75 million for the backlog is our biggest single deferred maintenance renewal replacement project, the design of the combined heat and power plant. And we absolutely need to move forward on design of combined heat and power. And so we're soliciting their support there. The governor's budget does not include the funding for the second half of the engineering building. We will be breaking ground for that building on March 30th and have enough funding to get it shelled in, but we'll run out of money in about May or June of 2014 and stop the project for a while, absent new funding in this legislative session. And then the governor's budget did not include any of the three capital research projects. One piece is somewhat covered. We asked for funding for research on Chinook salmon production issues, and the governor's budget does include some money to fish and game, a portion of which would be likely to come to us. But on energy issues, on the oil spill response, and on mapping, none of that funding was included. On the operating side, the governor funded 50% of the cost of pay increases, funded the cost of opening the Margaret Murray building, the life sciences building, and that's it. No funding for any of our other fixed cost increases, utilities. We had a request in for the expense of our conversion to the Hockey Association. Other fixed costs across, none of those were funded. So a very bare bones budget. You know, in some ways, I guess the unfortunate news is the best predictor over the years of how well we do in Juneau is what the governor gives us. Last year was an anomaly. We did remarkably better in the legislative process. And this year, the Fairbanks delegation is particularly strong in the finance arena, so we're hopeful that we can pick that up. We had great support from Bethel. Senator Hoffman in the last legislature, you know, with Senator Kelly and Coghill and bishops all in key leadership positions in the Senate. That should be a real plus for us going into this session. And then Senator Thompson and Wilson and Kawasaki and Guttenberg all on the House Finance Committee will be strong. So we'll be coming back to talk with staff counsel about ways we can use the power of the faculty and staff and students at UAF to influence the legislature to give us back some of what we think we need in the governor's budget. That's the primary piece of news. I did want to alert people to one thing. We have some discussions going on about next year's closure during the holidays. The holidays next year, the official holidays are Wednesday, Thursday, so that's Christmas Day and the day after, and then New Year's Day and the day after. So the normal closure would be the 27th and then the 30th, 31st, and then you'd come back for one day on the 3rd for that Friday. And we're wondering whether we should do a campus-wide closure that day as well. That would be a fourth day. For most people coming back many will take it anyway under soft closure. And the question is, do we want to keep open or not? So I'd be interested in thoughts. We're going to do a little bit of data collection before we make a decision. We have to think about the impact of Wintermester. We have to think about the impact on research projects. We want to go in and look at how many people are taking leave without pay now for the closure so that we have a sense of what's the, you know, what's the hardship impact that this might cause for some people. I'd like to be in a situation to make a decision by the 1st of February or thereabouts so that we get, so people can make appropriate vacation plans or other plans if they're going to do so. And again, would solicit your thoughts as staff counsel and from those of your constituents before we make a final decision. It will, if not a hard closure, it will certainly be a soft closure so that any department that wants to close that day can close that day. It really becomes whether we effectively close the campus or not. The 2 days before Christmas, the 23rd, 24th, we will not do a hard closure on those days for sure because there are enough functions with exams, grades, et cetera, that need to come in. But again, some offices may choose to close on one or both of those days, and we won't prohibit that. So effectively, that whole 2 weeks, you know, any office that the employees choose, we're not going to say you have to stay open. But at this point, stick with the 3 days, make a decision on whether a fourth day, either 1st of February, or I may wait till after your first meeting in February, actually more likely now thinking about it, because the Faculty Senate doesn't meet until February. I'll want to hear from them as well. So probably be mid-February before a decision's made. But I do think it's important to get the word out early, very early on that. And with that, let me take any questions that members may have.
Since the implementation of the soft closure, have you seen significant savings?
The soft closure is really not a, the hard closure is there are dollar savings. The soft closure is really not as much about savings as it is about giving people permission to take longer time off. And really it's the idea that we don't expect any offices to have to be open during that period means whoever makes the last decision to go on vacation can go on vacation. So I don't think there are significant savings from soft closure. It really is much more about communicating to the public that the kind of services that we traditionally offer, the access that we offer to our offices is not going to be the same during the soft closure.
One thought about an additional hard closure day would be just leave time accrued before that happens. I know, I can't remember the exact rates. I know when I was hired at the very beginning of November, I had just enough leave to take the 3 days off for the hard closure. So I know if you add another day that you need to give people, we don't need to give, but people would need a little more time to build leave.
That issue is a significant, so one impacted group is new hires.
Right.
For the 3 day or whether it's a 3 day or 4 day, and so that's a question we'll need to look at. What, you know, how many people is that affects? I know there've been proposals in the past that we allow essentially borrowing of leave, allow leave to go negative during the period. Personally, I favor that, but there are people who seem to have a problem with it.
And then also letting new hires know that it's coming up.
Yeah,
I think it was just luck that I didn't decide to take a 3 day weekend before, you know, before Christmas.
And that's
not a good time for it.
It's in the all letters of hire, but I'm not sure we all read those in the level of detail and understand what the true impact is. Thanks. That's good advice.
Brian, just a few questions. One, the things that we're asking for in addition to the governor's budget, those were in the region's budget.
In the region's budget,
yeah,
yes.
So we're not asking for anything that's beyond the region's.
We would never dream
of that. I'm just double checking. Maybe something came up. The design of the power plant, that was still allowing a conversion to natural gas?
The
plans for doing the design.
We're in the permitting process now. And we're in an interesting situation because we would anticipate if there are no protests to the permit issuance in June, July. At that point, we'll know sort of which direction we're going into design. We continue to favor the existing coal waste biomass plan. The difference in cost is fairly significant, converting to natural gas versus coal, and creates a surprising challenge. The coal plant reduces SOx and NOx emissions. The gas, which we continue to investigate, should there be natural gas, would increase our PM2.5 emissions because of secondary condensation of the natural gas exhaust, which doesn't go through a baghouse, unlike a coal plant, which goes through a baghouse and cleans out the. So it would impact PM2.5 if we were to do a gas-fired plant here. We're still working through what those numbers and issues would be to be able to look at the essentially three alternatives: coal waste, biomass, gas, if there's gas, or do nothing and slowly crater down.
When you say biomass, do you also include like ground up trees, spruce, that sort of thing?
Yes, the proposal for the coal waste and biomass plant, which is a circulating fluidized bed, essentially suspends everything in a burning chamber that's about two stories high. It can burn almost anything. Its sort of sweet spot is about 70% coal. The biomass could be barley, could be wood chips, could be waste from the pellet plant, could be ground up willow, a number of different options there. And we would then also look at our municipal solid waste from the campus and look at what portions of that we would want to combust. You know, certainly portions of it, if it's reusable, I would rather recycle than combust, like the plastics, for example. But it's remarkably efficient to, combustion. In fact, it increases the BTUs we get out of each ton of coal because it's much more complete combustion than the current technology, which is really late 1800s technology.
So the reason I asked that question is forestry this past week had made some movement forward on opening up those areas to allow, as black spruce harvesting. Do we have dealers out to those groups to find out if we can set up contracts for that or not, or is it not a possibility?
So we've been out with a request with an RFI for biomass for the new plant to find out sort of who's out there and to begin negotiations with them. We've also met with the Division of Forestry about they do a certain number of clearing for fire breaks and essentially have left their slash in rows is to set up for, as they do that in the future, that we'd essentially come in and take most likely through a contractor. You know, we wouldn't do it ourselves, but we'd be looking for biomass wherever we can get it. We've looked, there's sources in Delta as well, but it looks as if the cost of transportation and to get barley and other waste up is probably not going to pay off. And Fort Greeley wants to use that barley too, so we may see a competitive supply. So we will continue to look for any source of biomass we can for the plant.
Any questions online for Chancellor Rogers? Rick?
So if we didn't get the other half of the engineering building, so can we still open it and do something with the other half?
No. Essentially, what we're building with the first contract shells in the entire building, and so it would be, say, in about the condition that the life sciences building was in January of this year, which is to say, you know, the sides are up, the insulation's up, it's orange, and it's got some glass, and it's got some heat in it, but but we stopped working.
Okay.
So, and really, the, it, in, at that point then, we're, the second phase then does the interior for all but one of the floors. We actually, one of the floors will be unfinished as we're building it, with the idea being that it'll be future grants and contracts that will pay for building that out. But we actually, looking at the site that we had, if we were going to make effective use of that site, we wanted to maximize what we could do, and so we added an unfinished floor. Even if we get full funding, that floor is unfinished, so that we have that expansion space in the future. Groundbreaking scheduled for March 30th for that building and for the addition to Wood Center. We sold the bonds on Friday for the addition to Wood Center, so that will, the Wood Center construction will start March 30th, will be completed in the fall of 14, and we'll move all food service into Wood Center at that point. So that's going forward. It's pretty exciting. What we get a, there'll be a, where the Sun Star has been, that lower level, that becomes a coffee house area, and then upstairs a much larger dining area. I think it will be very attractive for faculty and staff for lunch compared with what we've had. So we expect more opportunity for faculty and staff use, as well as a lot more student traffic through Wood Center. Then in the winter of 14, we'll start work on redoing the Tilley Commons to become bookstore and welcome center. So that's progressing nicely. Be a neat plan.
Did the final P3 project include the one dorm, or did that drop out?
No housing in this phase. Okay. We've got a request in basically to do the four units, 100 units of housing. We need a $30 million capital subsidy for that.
For all four?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Because I know there was talk about just doing the one.
Yeah, and the numbers didn't pencil. We basically, in order to do this project, we had about $1.5 million worth of annual revenue from housing and dining that we could put into this project, and the final ended up being $1.45 million plus cost to do what we're doing. And part of that is essentially grafting an addition onto an existing building adds challenges to the project, because we need Wood Center to keep operating through this period.
And I'm familiar with some of the facility challenges at Wood Center, too.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
I have
a
quick question.
Happy holidays.
You too.
I have one question.
Oh.
Sorry. I just thought about this when you were mentioning that the Tilley Center, Lola Tilley Center, will become the bookstore and stuff. What will happen in Constitution Hall then?
So the plan for Constitution Hall, we don't have a firm plan, but in general, it's student club and organization use is the plan for that, so that we can try to, you know, we've got a lot of student clubs, and trying to address their needs. That's sort of tentative plan, but at this point we're, you know, we're into 2016-17 for that, and we haven't made a firm decision because we really need to see where we are in 4 years. At that point, we'll probably make a decision in 15-16 as to exactly what goes in there. But that's the idea. On the other hand, it's great open space, and so the question is, are there other things that could go there? The question, should we move post office, is out there as to whether that stays or goes, open issue at this point. The lack of parking near the bookstore is the main thing driving the bookstore change. Question is whether post office, you know, there could be some advantages in moving that as well. On the other hand, it's got unique construction issues, so, you know, to accommodate, and so do we want to redo that or not? So that's a decision for a future date. But in general, our thinking is get more student activity in the Wood Center Constitution Hall together.
Great, thank you.
Great time.
Thank you.
All right, then, for the record, we had someone join us later in the meeting. May I ask you to give your name?
Yeah, this is Ryan Keel.
Thank you. And also in the room, we have two individuals I recognize, but I don't remember your names. Will you please state them for the record?
I'm Trish Winters from the power plant.
Okay.
Francis Cooper from EHS.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. All right, then we'll move to the officer's report. Myself, a lot going on. I do... Most of which I guess will pop up later in on the agenda, so I'll keep it. I really don't have anything separate to add and under the officer reports. But actually, I'd like your feedback. You know, in the past, with PIPS's reports last year, and I really didn't jump into it this year. We had written reports, president's report before, that came out with the agenda. I've asked you this before, and now that we're halfway into the year, I want to confirm. I guess. My preference is not to put it in writing because a lot of it's changing. You know, some things happened yesterday, for example, that I would add to the report. And so how do you feel about my verbal additions under the agenda items versus an all-in-one president's report? Thoughts or comments or preferences? Does it work for you the way that we've been going, or do you prefer a written report?
I like to have a written report only because, one, it kind of puts it in kind of pretty, it can be concise,
mm-hmm.
you know, addressing whatever issues, you know, mm-hmm. just briefly, if such a thing is possible.
Well, yeah,
but, you know, and I realize stuff changes, but it gives me a starting point to mm-hmm. kind of wrap my head around.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I was thinking, but for me, the written report doesn't need to come before the meeting. It could come
at the meeting.
At the meeting, and then maybe take all the things and sort of summarize them,
okay.
sort of, and send it out a week later or whatever.
Okay.
As opposed to picking through the minutes.
You can go ahead, Jennifer. The chancellor's done.
Okay.
Yeah, I will then from here forward make an effort to have a written report for you all. You know, it's quite a workload, but I will try to do that. Summarize my thoughts. A lot of times, honestly. What happens is as I'm talking with you about the issue and you ask questions, then it's like, oh, I remember that piece and I can tell you that, where if I had sat down and thought about it, I might not have you prodded out of me.
My view is I wouldn't grade you on it. I mean, it's just, whatever, you know, best effort.
I grade myself. And the other thing about the written, though, is it's important for you to put it in context and put it in the timeline, because things are changing quickly enough that one of the comments that has come from President Gamble is incorrect information out there, rumors and incorrect facts out there. And if I put it in writing in January or December and then come January, it's no longer accurate. The challenge there is for people to remember that.
What about the potential of doing like a bullet list related to the topics? I mean, for me, the only thing I need is something to refer back to for a memory aid.
Okay. Something that comes out before the next meeting's minutes. Okay.
Like, or at the time, either way, I mean, from my perspective, all I need to know is what you're going to tell us about.
Okay. Beyond the agenda. Okay. All right.
I mean, I'm not against a
RIP
report either. I just...
No. Okay. I'll work on that then for the rest of the meetings.
It's nice from a historical perspective, too. When people, I mean, there's been several times where I've looked back through notes of previous minutes of president's reports to see what's happening. Then, so.
Okay.
But I agree, you know, minimal information is something that we can add to the historical record of what we're doing, I think.
Okay.
And as long as you put draft on it, then of course, they can't hold you to it.
Yeah.
Or just where we are today.
Yeah.
Things have changed. I mean, it's a constant deliberation with most of this.
Yes, exactly. Okay. All right. Thank you for the input, and I would encourage you to do that anytime when I ask for it. it's a constantly evolving thing. Then I'll pass it to Claudia. And then we'll jump to Jennifer.
I usually write my notes down anyway beforehand, so so staff alliance met on December 11th, and staff in the that in the government office, I guess that's what it's called. Nora Tolman is the new executive system officer, and then Anthony is the government coordinator. So I guess Joella and Jennifer and everybody will be happy that they finally have staff over there who can help out. Yeah, President Gamble joined us for a while at the Staff Alliance meeting, and he actually had printed out the entire survey with all the comments. He had it in a book format, and he said that he read the entire thing, and he thought it was very helpful. Most helpful for him was the benefits, the promotion, and the supervisor training, and that the real messages were in the comments, and he actually read all the comments and made notes on it. It was pretty impressive that he had the whole thing with him in a book format almost.
Wait, were the comments categorized, or were they just sort of randomly...
Remember the survey? We had the comments went with the questions.
Okay.
We had the comments with the
questions. That was only phase one that we saw, if I remember.
Right, yes. The survey also had an ending question, you know, an open-ended your comments here. And so there were 200 pages worth of comments that he had read and very thoroughly analyzed, had questions about, and like she said, he found lots of things in the comments that he wanted to follow up on. I was really shocked when he sat down with that book and said, this is what I got out of this, and wanted
to... He said there was a lot of food for thought in there, about longevity, but then he said most of it will apply for statewide, for his administration at statewide, because he can't make the decision for the other MAUs. He doesn't want to tell the chancellors what to do. He can make his recommendation, and they can maybe we can talk to the chancellor and tell them if we can follow the same model or what do we want to do. But he doesn't want to tell the chancellors what to do. So that was a sketch from that one. He also talked about the JHCC motion that came out, and especially the opt-out, and he wants to see more numbers before he makes a decision. And he said that we're going to hold, JHCC and him are going to hold town hall meetings after Christmas, so we have a two-way conversation and people talk about it. He's not sold on this as all the best options yet. He needs to see hard numbers. And then the tuition waiver, he came and showed us, and we're going to talk about that a little later. And that was pretty much what...
Did you see the notice that the meeting for you, the town hall for UAS is January 17th?
Yes. Yeah, we actually, we hadn't been formally informed of the dates yet. But yes, for Fairbanks, January 17th is the date. They haven't set a location yet, and certainly statewide hasn't announced yet it officially.
Yeah, they had, at Staff Healthcare Committee, they mentioned it 17th, 18th in Anchorage, and then the 22nd in Juneau. I've got it in my notes.
Right.
We can talk about that.
Right. Anything else?
I think that was...
Okay, then we'll move to governance reports, and Jennifer Reynolds, the President of Faculty Senate, is in the room for those online.
I am in the room, and I have actually six things to mention to you. Most of them are very quick, but just to tell you what we're working on. One is there's a new software package that all three MAUs are looking at. This is called CourseLeaf. Some of you have gotten a chance to take a look at it. The UAA has already decided to adopt it. UAS is on the verge of that. The faculty and department administrative staff were given a special demonstration of our part of it and liked it very much. This is software that is used to manage changes and additions to courses and academic programs. So it would be an online system that would organize all this. It links directly into the catalog. So all the details in the course changes would automatically go into the catalog, which is an unbelievably good thing compared to how it's done now. It also would link directly into DegreeWorks, which is the student advising software. So this looks like an immense time saver and detail organizer for us. That's called CourseLeaf. And the registrar is looking at bids, or not bids, but at the budget for it now.
And Jennifer, would this replace Blackboard?
No.
Okay.
It's something quite different from Blackboard.
Okay.
So this is on the administrative end, and
okay,
the faculty would use it when proposing or changing courses.
Okay.
That's why faculty were involved in this.
And how does UAS feel?
We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I was a little surprised that UAA had moved on it so quickly, because as far as I know, they hadn't talked to their faculty about it, but it looks very good, so I don't think their faculty need to be concerned.
Okay.
But UAF actually asked us to take a look at it before they jumped in.
Okay, thank you.
The second item is the Intercollegiate Athletic Council. I'm aware that you all have a representative on this, and frankly, that was how I was getting a lot of information about it, because there were minutes from that those meetings coming to you.
Mm-hmm.
Danny Shepard has been very active this year in trying to connect the IAC with the Faculty Senate. She's been attending all of our meetings and speaking at most of them. We have no Faculty Senate appointments on it right now because I'm waiting for them to restructure and reorganize before I make new appointments. But I'm happy to say that the connections are much stronger now. That means there will be much better academic connection into the athletics department. Faculty Senate passed a revised attendance policy, and this will affect general absences and UAF-sanctioned absences from classes. It's mainly a clarification, but it's completely reworded. I can give you the text of it if anybody wants to see it. It does not mention military-sanctioned absences because we're going to deal with that separately. It's not a UAF sanction. It's a military sanction.
And this is a policy, where does it sit?
It's going to be in the catalog.
Okay.
So what we've done is revised the language that is published in the catalog and in the online system as well.
Is there now a requirement for attendance, or what? I'm just curious what number this is.
This started because of concerns about excused absences for athletic events. There was a lot of uproar about that. There was actually a couple of students trying to claim excused absences because they were fans who had to travel to Anchorage for an event. I mean, there was just all kinds of silliness going on. And so what this clarifies is whose responsibility is it when this happens or that happens? What should the student expect? What should the faculty member expect? So it clarifies those things. The way absences are handled are still and always the prerogative of the faculty member. And what it says is the student, if you know you've got absences coming up during the semester and they're UAF sanctioned, you have to have documentation, you go to your faculty member at the beginning of the semester before the add drop deadline. If the faculty member says, if faculty tries to figure out how to cope with this, if there is not a way to deal with these absences that lets you still learn the material, you should drop the class. And it says this in the policy. Okay, so that's the sort of clarification I'm talking about. Whose responsibility is to do what?
So then are you guys further requiring faculty to include that in the syllabus requirement?
No. We try and have as few requirements for the syllabus as possible. So is that. Then the next one is the Faculty Senate approved two new minors. One is in interdisciplinary studies, which sounds like a non sequitur. It's a minor in interdisciplinary studies. But what it is a student-designed minor. It has to be on a coherent subject, and it has to be approved by the advisor and the dean of general studies. So the student can create a minor on some coherent subject and apply to have it approved as an official minor, and it would say that the name of that minor in the transcript. The second minor that was approved was in emergency management, and this is through the School of Management. And we amended the transfer credit policy. This is a fairly big deal. Currently, the Board of Regents regulations state, and we follow this, that if a student completes their general education requirements at any of the three Alaskan MAUs, then that completion transfers to the others. So if someone completes the general ed requirements at UAA, they don't have to deal with the UAF general ed requirements at all. They're just considered to have completed it. So the new policy expands that to all four-year accredited institutions. All right? The catch is that the student is responsible for getting certification from that institution that they completed the Gen Ed requirements. Our registrar is not responsible for that.
By all four-year accredited institutions, even outside Alaska?
Yes.
When you say general requirements, are you talking like core?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So they need more than their transcripts, sounds like.
If they want to be, if they want UAF to consider that they've completed the core or don't have to deal with the core, then the student has to get certification from the other institution that they completed that institution's core or gen ed or whatever they call it there. Otherwise, our registrar's office would get completely bogged down. But this gives the student a way to do it.
As opposed to doing it class by class.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. Exactly. And the last thing is electronic course evaluations. This the Senate looked at this in 2009-2010 academic year. Provost's office has asked that we do it again. And so one of the Faculty Senate committees and Eric Madsen on behalf of the Provost's office are now going through demonstrations of all of the software packages they were able to find that are available for students to do electronic course evaluations rather than the written ones that they do now. There are a dozen of these, and the demos are happening between November and March. Two of them, we've passed two of them so far. Okay, that's what I have to report.
Any questions online? In the room?
Just on the last topic?
Yeah.
Is there any concern that there will be less feedback as a result of having them electronic?
There is massive concern about that. That is, there is a set of formal criteria that the committee drew up before they began this, and that is a major criterion there, that we have to have adequate response rate. I don't think it even requires us to have the same response rate that we have now, but just adequate. UAA considers they do not have an adequate response rate, and UAS does something different. Anyway, so yeah, that's a huge concern.
They don't consider they get an adequate response rate with their current paper system?
UAA does an electronic system, and they switched both the questions and they switched to electronic at the same time. There's a lot of argument about which ones have caused the low response rate. But,
you know, I've often wondered this. I've seen what some other institutions do where the students actually run all the evaluations and they publish them in a manner that's easy for students to get to. But I don't know that we really have any sort of published thing that's publicly available that people can go and reference and see, you know, how this course did, how this instructor did, such like that. And so if you actually offer that, then you're probably, if you make it more useful, then you might get more response. I don't know.
They are,
I doubt that's the direction the Faculty Senate will be interested in going.
I would understand that.
Okay.
But that's, I think, why it's often student-run, where that's been successful.
Gary, I can't speak to exactly what ASUAF does now, but I'm pretty sure ASUAF keeps a log that's, at least in paper, that's referenceable.
Right.
So
you have to go down and look at it.
Yeah. Right. But I'm saying that student government does keep that.
Yeah.
That's a faculty senate issue. To me, the whole move to an electronic system like that after the fact or not timed is that the only ones who bother are the negatives.
Yep. So, yeah, there. That's one of the big questions. The motivations for moving towards it or for the provost asking us to move towards it are the cost and logistics of the current paper system, and her concern that there are security issues with the current paper system. The obvious response is that there are also security issues with electronic systems, but those are the two reasons that she's given us for looking at this. So we're looking.
Any other questions? Did you want to speak to the tuition benefit in particular on anything, or?
I will wait until you get to that subject. I'm just going to listen to hear what you say.
Okay. All right, then if there's nothing else, we'll move on. I'm assuming Mari is not online. Mari Freitag, the president of ASUAF. And we have no other ASUAF representatives. Am I correct? All right, then we'll move to item six, unfinished business, staff council, odd unit elections.
Yay, they're done. we had a pretty awesome response rate this year, and I was quite surprised by the number of people who actually accepted write-in nominations during the election time. Somewhat unprecedented. In OIT, for example, there were, I think, about 16 write-in candidates that came through, and they all thought, well, why is Richard the only one doing this? So they either wrote themselves in or they wrote other people in, and they're actually going to have full representation.
In fact, they're taking over staff council, trying to fit them all on the calendar.
So, you haven't heard about that.
So I'm not sure that the best way to proceed on this. We have a motion to approve them. I don't have a copy of it. I don't think. Yes. So we have one that says that we've reviewed and we certify the election results. Bylaw states that election results are to be announced at the December staff council meeting with newly elected representatives officially beginning their two-year term on January 1st, 2013. Would you guys like to hear the people who are going to be serving? I'm surprised.
Yes, that'd be great.
I'm sorry, go ahead online.
Yes, I would like to hear the people's names.
I'm getting up, but having some mobility issues today, so I'll just be louder. So from Unit 1, we have gotten two reps and two alts. Adam Kane was voted in as Representative 1. Kristen Bay is Representative 2. Alternate 1 will be Evelyn Pinsgard. Alternate 2 will be Selena Brown. For Unit 3, Representative 1 will be Debbie Gonzalez. Representative 2 will be Leslie Walls. Unit 5, Representative 1 will be Deborah Coxon. Representative 2 will be Jesse
Atencio.
Atencio, thank you. And Representative 3 from Unit 5 will be Aaron Albertson. From Unit 7, we have two representatives that are in that. Representative 1 will be Ashley Munro, and Representative 2 will be Ryan Keeley. On Unit 9, Representative 1, Blevins, Representative 2, Juan Lula. In Unit 11, we have Trish Winters. Thank you for coming in. In Unit 13, the two representatives will be Brad Crick and Jeanette Altman. In Unit 15, and this is the full one because they actually get three rep seats and three alt seats, Richard Machito will be first representative. Yarko,
Toivonen
will be representative two. Representative three will be Chris Bex. Alternate one will be Tom Langdon. Alternate two will be Cynthia Collins. And alternate three will be Tony Abbey. So are there any questions about the election results?
So are all the rep seats full?
I do not believe so. We're missing some from, let me just look back real quick.
We're missing six.
Right.
But we gained.
But we've had a gain, that is correct.
Yes.
And we have no empty units this year. Right? Every unit has a rep this year.
In the odds, yeah.
In the odds. And in the evens too. There's no missing rep units in the evens from the calendar.
I just have to reference something for sure, but I believe you're correct.
Well, this is outstanding. How did the voting this year compare to past years? Are we up or normal or?
Oh, you mean for
number of votes?
Participation?
Yes.
I think the participation was really good. I could go and look at the number of people. It was around 200 votes that came in, and I don't have a unique number of people that voted.
Okay.
But the process went a little smoother. There's still more to be done to refine it so that it is kind of a turnkey every year. So.
Okay.
And Walker, there's only two units that have alts in them in the odd.
Yeah. 15 is one of them, and I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah, 1 and 15.
1 and 15, there's one zero 15. Alts for all of the other ones.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for Walker other than his awesomeness?
Yeah. So, Walker, I didn't hear your name being read for Unit 13.
You are correct.
Walker is stepping down. Does that mean you're interested, Robin, in chairing EMR?
No.
Any questions or concerns then, and do we have a motion to ratify the election results?
So moved.
Second.
Questions or concerns for Walker and EMR?
No, just a lot of thanks.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, then, hearing none, do we need to do a roll call vote on ratifying election?
No.
No? Okay. All right, then, all those in favor of ratifying motion on the floor, that is ratifying the odd number numbered unit election results from the fall 2012 staff council elections. Say aye.
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 All those opposed? Hearing none, then, we have ratified the elections. Outstanding.
Do we know when the calendar might be coming out?
Let's hold off on that. We have a report coming on the agenda, coming later on the agenda. Nicole has asked that we clarify who's online again, and so I had Deb Gonzalez.
Yes.
Kim Eames. Evelyn Pinsgaard.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what did you need me for? This is Kim.
Kim, we just needed to make sure we're clarifying who's online, documenting who's online for the last vote.
Yep, I am.
Robin?
Yes.
Nicole Klupfer?
Present.
Ryan Keel?
Present.
And then did I miss anyone else?
Ashley Monroe.
And Jennifer Youngberg.
All right, thank you everyone online. So next agenda item then is construction going on. Actually, I'd like to take
a moment. Sorry, that's my building. I'll mute it.
No worries. I'd like to take a moment in particular to thank Walker. I've been with council, staff council, for several years off and on, and throughout it, Walker has been a solid force in keeping us on track and out of trouble, and in fact made great strides in improving our elections process, our constitution, our bylaws, and so on. And I personally want to thank Walker for his commitment to keeping us going and on the right track. I can't emphasize enough that it's a weight off the officer's shoulders, and having someone like Walker and chairing EMR and his commitment and his, you know, passionate hard work. I want to thank you very much, Walker.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for the words there. I'm looking for anyone who wants to chair me at this point. And
yes.
I don't plan on completely disappearing because I do want to stay involved. So
you will provide the incoming chair with your wisdom, and
they think that, yeah.
All right. We'll make a push on that in January with the new membership, and in February with orientation. My goal is in one of those meetings to push very hard for a new chair of EMR. Anything else, Walker?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Item B is the healthcare benefit update. This is, as always, fun. I encourage you to pay attention to the Staff Alliance blog and to the Staff Council blog and get the word out. When people ask you where you heard that statement, if you got it from there, tell them. Tell them the URL and get them to go there. The situation is, the Healthcare Task Force, and I want to emphasize this word. The Healthcare Task Force last summer made suggestions. They did not make recommendations. They specifically directed Donald Smith and the administration recognize these as suggestions to JHCC to look into more, to take input on, and so on. They were not recommendations. They've been repeatedly misidentified. And so then those suggestions went to JHCC, who jumped on a number of them and passed the 9 motions making changes, recommending and making changes to the FY14 healthcare benefit. So then Donald Smith accepted those recommendations and indicated in his memo that is in the attachments and on the blog that he was going forward preparing to make those changes in the FY14 plan. Then we raised a little brouhaha. Staff said, wait a minute, in particular on the opt-out, removing the opt-out, which is identified as motion number 6. So we jumped up and down about that, and President Gamble heard it, indicated that he would push for the Joint Healthcare Committee to hold town hall style meetings that we talked about on January 17th in Fairbanks, and we will get the word out when it's official and when we know a location. But then along came the Regents meeting last week, and I'm happy to say that the Regents did not favor taking away the opt-out. In particular, they asked and indicated they thought that this was the wrong thing to do fiscally. That is, why would you bring more people onto the plan, force more people onto the plan that may well increase the cost of the plan? So it was really good to hear. Donald Smith presented those motions to the Regents, and was questioned pretty hard. It was really good, really good. President Gamble, following Donald's report to the Regents, publicly said, "We will have town halls. Nothing is final yet." I assure you, however, Donald Smith's department is going forward. Making these changes, preparing to make these changes so that if the go-ahead is given, they're ready to put out the FAQs, put out the information on the changes, and by the open enrollment. So we will keep you updated. My guess is, and this is purely my guess, based on the Regents' response to the opt-out, it probably won't happen. But I urge you to keep telling people to comment on the blog. I have no doubt in my mind that President Gamble reads that blog. He made very specific references to comment. So I think it's really important. I have received many emails opposing removing the opt-out, every one of them I've responded by, please take this comment and put it on the blog as well, because it encourages other people to comment, and it gives perspective to President Gamble and anyone else who reads it. So with that, Gary has a question here in the room.
What was the administration's response to the Regents' question about why you would accept a potential $1.2 million liability for $480,000 of income?
Donald, the line that we've been receiving from Donald and Erica Van Flying for well over a year, because they've been pushing removing the opt-out for quite a while. And when I questioned them over a year ago, their response was, you want to increase the size of your pool, right, to spread the costs, one. And two, the state doesn't allow opt-outs. So on the one hand, you want the same benefits as the state, but you don't. So that's been their response, and that was his response to the Regents, was the state doesn't allow an opt-out, and we're increasing the size of the pool, but the Regents didn't bite on either one of them.
Okay, and with regards to comments, one of the comments that he made on at Staff Healthcare was that he would like them not to be so emotional. I'm just going to tell you this, and that,
that's,
you know, more fact-based, or you know.
That sounds like Donald Smith.
So,
but here's the thing, and if you look at one of the blog comment or posts, I indicated it's important that President Gamble realize. One, he's a numbers man, but behind those numbers are people, his employees, and the reality is when it comes to being able to afford health care or stretch their paycheck, it's an emotional issue. And he needs to recognize that. And I the regents, from, you know, that I was there, I heard their comments, they got it, that it's more than the numbers. At least half of them did. Jennifer.
Yeah, two things, and these come from Faculty Alliance and our interactions with President Gamble. One is that, yes, the opt-out is under particular scrutiny. The other item that's under scrutiny is the spousal fee. So those are the two that President Gamble has directed everybody to look at carefully and justify. And the other point, what was the other one was, that our understanding in the Faculty Alliance is that it's slightly different from the way you phrased what Human Resources is doing. Yes, they're moving forward on all of these recommendations, but what our understanding is that they are looking at the details of implementing these, the legal implications, the logistical implications, and roadblocks. If there are legal impediments to implementing any of them, for example, they will, that will eliminate one of these options. So it isn't that all of these are a done deal unless the employees block them. There are other possible reasons why they may be blocked as well.
Certainly.
Wanted to put that out there.
Yes. Yes, that's true. In particular, I'm trying to remember which one in particular they were concerned about legal issues, but yes. But, you know, feedback on all of them is important. I think, you know, one of the things that I've observed in these the task force meetings and the committee meetings is that they forget that they forget the struggle with the implementation and they forget the impacts on people. And we need to make those clear. Certainly not everything is going to make everybody happy. And some things go to the greater good, but we just have to make sure that we have a real picture of what that is.
So do the faculty have a general response to? Faculty Alliance is not intending to get into this because we regard it as a matter of faculty unions. I think we are only. Trying to understand because we're getting a lot of questions.
Right.
So we're trying to understand the situation, and if there's a gap in what should be happening, then we're willing to step in. But because President Gamble had already decided to have these town hall meetings and try and get more input, so we're not being active in this right now. We're watching it.
So are you encouraging faculty to attend?
Yes. Yes. So I've sent out to the Faculty Senate the notice of the January 17th town meeting. Said, please tell anybody who asks you that this is going to happen.
And there's one town meeting for all of UAS. Is that the idea?
They were talking about potentially having them at two different times of the day.
Yeah.
But not more than two.
Yeah, they haven't given details to governance.
They haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah.
And for the opt-out, I assume that people are doing lots of analyses what the potential impact is for the opt-out.
Apparently, they actually have given some numbers.
They did actually. Based on the 110 that opted out this last year, they figured out, and the way it was presented, it was kind of interesting. They presented just the 18% cost to the plan of $210,000, I think it was. And then they said, and we could have gotten $480,000 in premiums, essentially. But then when you look at that 18% represents actually $1.2 million to the plan and for $480,000. So there becomes a deficit. So it was an interesting kind of a game there.
Yeah, the question has always been, I mean, who are the opt-outs? And that's something that we've asked for information on, you know, the opt-outs. They're surmising the opt-outs are younger people who and healthier who don't feel that they need the coverage, that expensive coverage. They can get away with a lesser expensive somewhere else kind of thing because they're younger and healthier. Well, we've not seen specifics
yet. Yeah, and the total numbers are something like 400. There's something like 400 some odd opt-outs. So
yeah, they're saying that
we're not dual university employees.
Yeah, the numbers that Donald gave to the Regents was there are 573 opt-outs, 423, I think, would actually be impacted by it because the proposal as it's going forward right now is with dual employees that are exempt from it. Any other comments or questions on the healthcare benefit?
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Does anybody know what the Regent's view was on the spousal surcharge?
There, I believe it was Regent Fisher made a passing comment about the spousal surcharge. He wasn't in favor, but that was one Regent, one question, one comment, and
mm-hmm.
certainly not the emphasis.
I don't know if anyone knows this, it may be too early, but if any of this is passed, any or all or whatever, is it going to be made easy to be able to, I don't know if I'm wording this right. So the spousal surcharge will affect me, myself, but my husband's on a yearly fiscal plan, and so basically I'm going to have to be paying double to keep him on for 6 months until he can finally change over to his work plan.
The actual implementation details, they obviously, that's what I was mentioning earlier, they're still sorting that out and looking at what the process would be and so on, and that there certainly would be exemptions where it wouldn't seem logical for the university to do that to you. But those are a case by case because they're exceptions,
mm-hmm.
Or a small number. And so the details yet, no, this has all been at the broad, big, you know, the broad picture level, not the on the ground level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There was also one discussion about grandfathering people in.
Yes.
And
yes.
That hasn't, and that's all part of the mix.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A coworker and I discussed that because my coworker also has a spouse whose open enrollment period is 6 months after
mm-hmm.
our open enrollment.
That's
and so I passed that back along to Melody at UAA and the other staff rep on JHCC, and I'll encourage it to be brought up at one of the town hall meetings. But I suggested to them, and I don't know if there's any discussion, but waiving it if you can get your spouse off within that calendar year,
right.
So you can avoid the surcharge since your intention is to remove them.
Good. Thank you for putting
This is Jennifer Youngberg, just coming from the human resource side. An involuntary change, a gain or a loss of health care, is considered a life event for most health care plans.
And it is for ours, but I don't know about other plans. And I know other plans have different criteria, at least in some cases. So you're probably right. It would be fine to remove your spouse, and then they would be able to say, this is a life event. But I don't know if all plans have that.
Are you continue with them on the plan until that mid-break, and that's a life event here?
Right, but then you would be paying the spousal surcharge until their open enrollment period. So you're right. So if their open enrollment period is 6 months later, you keep them on your plan until their open enrollment period. They change. That's a life event for you, so
right.
You can drop them from the plan.
I guess I was misinterpreting the spousal surcharge. Okay.
I
see what you're saying. No, it makes sense.
Well, and I don't know if it'll be monthly or not. I mean, if it's not monthly, maybe it won't matter if it's for the whole year or for 6 months.
Yeah. Any other questions online? So the key here then is communication, which we know and recognize is a challenge, getting the word out as far and wide as possible. The governance staff alliance is requested that the president's office work closely with them in developing the FAQs and things for open enrollment period. And even once, the decisions are made, or so we're told they're made, and not to dilly-dally and delay in telling us that the decisions have been made so we can begin the process of communicating out. So the next item, if there is nothing further on the healthcare benefit update.
I just have one more comment on that one. Just to point out that there looks to be a real PR problem for the university in terms of people, spouses and employees who have military health benefits and Indian Health Service benefits. And they don't seem to have thought about that yet.
I think they...
It's been discussed, TRICARE and all that.
Yeah.
It's been raised red flags.
Yeah.
No, the administration hadn't thought about it.
Not, well, they haven't. It's because they haven't listened to what
exactly.
we've been telling them.
That's what I'm pointing out.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think
keep
they...
Pointing
but
out.
Because this is a potential PR problem, my guess is that that is at least going to be an exception, if not actually overturn the policy.
Yeah. I think that he's taken enough heat and was surprised by the region's reactions as well. I think he's... But we need to keep up the pressure and the heat until it's a done deal, until we know it's gone. If there's nothing else, I'm going to move to the tuition benefit, which itself was another communication challenge. The situation there, as I was mentioning before, this group, Gary, we've been working on this for some time as well. The administration has since stopped discussing it with Staff Alliance last summer. And this has been a real roller coaster ride for Staff Alliance. The copy that you have was handed to us by Diane Mielke, the assistant to the president, on December 11th. It has not, to my knowledge, been formally sent out anywhere. It was handed to us because President Gamble came into our meeting and we asked him about it, and he said, oh, I signed that last week. Had Diane bring a copy. I sent it out to Alliance, and then Jennifer spotted it on our agenda and asked for a copy. It's my understanding it's not gone out, and I don't see any significant differences to what the last version we saw in October was, but we were told in October it was a done deal, and then since then have been told it was in review at General Counsel, but then suddenly found out it was signed. So again, I think it's a much better version than what we started on with Beth Boehner last year, I think the changes are reasonable. If there are impacts, if you hear people who are, well, besides the fact that we're just now hearing about it, and it is, as noted here, effective immediately, it does impact the spring semester, there will be some challenges there. The form hasn't been updated. The process, as I understand it, hasn't been updated. Jennifer?
So I called Anita Hartman last night in the Human Resources Office at UAF, and she had not heard anything about this. I sent her the document and copied it to our Interim Director of Human Resources. His name is Gary...
Fred.
Love. Yeah. Who I thought was going to be here at this meeting, she said, but not here. She said that they had not heard any of this. They had not seen the document, and there had not been any preliminary word into the Dean's Council or the other parts of UAF administration, which surprised her. She was going to try and find out what was going on. She also said, because my biggest concern was that this document states that it's effective immediately as of December 6th. And that, you know, on the face of it, means that it's effective for the spring semester. And I said this to her. She said, well, she's not certain that's the case because registration for spring semester opened November 4th. So this, if it was issued after registration began, that might mean that it's not effective for spring semester, but it's all very confusing and nobody knows what's going on. My guess is that probably Donald Smith did not think about the academic calendar when this was formalized.
We raised this in October. We repeatedly,
okay.
Hey, you know, we need to know well in advance of spring semester if you're going to do this.
Okay.
But. Yeah.
All right. So I've sent this to our Human Resources Department, hoping that they can get some clarity on it.
Yeah. Again, I would encourage you to, if you run across any issues, employees who make a complaint or a statement that, wait, this, how does this work? This doesn't work. I assure you that the financial aid people in the business office and the registrar's office will be making their comments back up the chain through it, and including HR. If there are any implementation issues with this, but as far as impacts on staff, please let us know if you hear of any.
I have one question. I'm not sure if I'm reading it correctly. So I don't know, the fourth or fifth one down says requirement for a 2.0 cumulative GPA or better. So to me, cumulative means your overall GPA, not a semester-to-semester GPA. So if, as a staff member, if I took a class and totally messed up and got an F or a D, but it didn't affect my, it didn't lower my cumulative to below 2.0, am I understanding that that's still okay?
And well, I'm looking in here for the particular part of the regulation that mentions that. Because that is something that we had gone, so I think it's item J, employees, spouses, and dependent children must maintain a 2.0 or better cumulative GPA to be eligible for undergraduate education benefits. Grade appeals, yeah. We had asked for the what they've done has been, they are very vague here. And this is where the challenge is going to be. Sometimes vague works to your advantage, sometimes it works to the administration's advantage. We had asked for the repercussion to be clearly stated in here, that if you failed a class, you had one semester to bring it up, and then if you didn't, you would lose the benefit for a semester. So I don't see that in here.
And I don't see anything that, I know one question that has come up many times in the people I've talked to has been the issue of taking a class for audit. It's a very popular thing to take a recreation class down at the SRC for audit, just, you know, so you can get some exercise in, but not penalize yourself if you miss more than, you know, four or six, depending on the class. Any word about that?
You mean as far as whether or not you can continue to do that?
Correct.
Jennifer, I have a question for you related to that.
Go ahead.
For the courses that are graded pass-fail, like the one-credit athletic courses,
yes.
Do they have any sort of GPA impact if they're pass-fail?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, if you fail, that gets averaged into your GPA.
Yeah. It gets one credit averaged into your GPA of one credit fail.
I just didn't know how it worked, if it was pass or fail. So
yeah, the other issue that we raised related to this was the cumulative GPA. We wanted it to be any course covered by that tuition waiver. Because for example, if you brought someone in and they had a low GPA already, and they you know, failed one class, their cumulative would drop below because they already, so we, in essence, we were saying that the administration was punishing people for prior work or work prior to their employment. And so they obviously, you know, again, this goes, they took that language out of there as well, that said it was, this minimum GPA was for courses covered by the tuition waiver. The feedback they received that administrative burden would be too great to limit it to courses covered by that tuition waiver. So it has its challenges, but all in all, Alliance felt it was a much better position than where we started, and I think, you know, their concession to us was upping the number of credits eligible, you know, in a year, conceding or giving us that because they took away the specific, the delay in punishment for failing a class and the specific reference to those covered by the tuition waiver rather than no cumulative. But this, I encourage
you. I think it's a good policy. I mean, as far as it reads, I mean, okay, there's a six-month waiting period. Okay, that's understandable. And the only other kind of ding on it is you can't use the tuition waiver for year-long classes anymore. But I do understand. I used to work for CDE, and I do understand that year-long classes are tending to go away. But, I mean, other than that, we get to take more credits in a year. We get to take more credits in a semester. And if it's truly reading, it's talking about your cumulative GPA. It's not talking about your semester GPA. So unless they worded it incorrectly, it's not a bad change, really.
Right. I still have a question about it that I had about it originally, which was, it's ambiguous as to whether or not the total number of credits apply to spouse as well as children, as well as yourself, or if it only applies, the limitation only applies to the employee as opposed to the spouse and children. With the way it's written currently, it appears that you could interpret it either way, and that is a problem in my mind. And this, we raised this question early on. We said, hey, it's not clear whether or not you're saying you can have 8 credits a semester and 16 a year for all who are your dependent.
Well, it says, I mean, item B very clearly states eligible regular employees of the university may have tuition waived for up to 16. So that's very specific, but farther down, what section in particular, I'm looking for spouses and dependent children under the age of 24 of eligible regular employees may have course credit hours waived as provided in this section.
Right, in this section of the region's policy, which means that they have only defined one possible set of waivers, that is 8 and 16.
Yeah.
I mean, that's still an issue.
Choice of language. Okay, well, what I can tell you is that we are going to put this up on the blog, both the UAF and Staff Alliance, and see, and ask for feedback on it, specific concerns. It will stay on Alliance's agenda. We will make formal inquiries with the registrar's office and so on as to any challenges that they're having with the implementation of it and how those challenges are affecting staff. And if there are, if we're hearing that there are regular issues with it, then this certainly goes into effect, but it doesn't mean it can't be changed, especially if we bring a substantive amount of concerns to the regions directly. So beyond that, I encourage you, when you see this go up, make your comments, Walker and Robin, and then we have a location for all these comments and can take them forward.
Okay.
Any other questions on this one then? Jennifer, any other comments on it?
No, thank you.
All right, then we'll move to Staff Resources website. It's just a reminder that it's been updated. Nicole Klopfer, are you still online?
I am.
All right, then at our November meeting, thank you, Jennifer, very much. Have a great holiday. Nicole, at our November meeting, some specific recommendations were given to the group regarding potential changes to the Staff Resources website. Can you tell us if those have been made or considered?
Well, the only one that hasn't been made yet is the safety one, and that's because they're transitioning. It went from someone in the main office helping us with it to moving it to a consultant, and so the communication has been a little choppy. Okay. But the recommended changes are in a template, and HR has it. So it's just a little more, you know, not poking the bear, but it will get done.
Okay. Okay. And you'll keep an eye on it for us?
Of course.
Thank you, ma'am. Any, unless there are comments on D, I'll move to E. The grievance process review, what I can tell you is that two members of Staff Alliance met with Paula Harrison, as I believe her name is, the labor employee relations individual with Statewide, late last week, and I have not seen their notes yet regarding that meeting, but the intent was for them to develop a flowchart for the process as it exists now and identify areas that weren't transparent or fair to staff. So that's still active.
Is there any ability to put some sort of hooks within either the grievance or the mediation program?
Some sort of what?
Hooks into the grievance or mediation program. I've tried to go through mediation with someone before, and they refuse to enter into mediation, and I think that's ridiculous.
I think the challenge is, I think, how can you make someone, if it's a performance issue, yes, then you can apply plenty of leverage to get them into the mediation process. If it's not a performance issue, then there's a challenge.
It was further complicated because one was not on staff and the person's faculty. And that sort of thing, I mean, the way we tout our university, we say, oh, we only take good people, we're only trying to do the best thing, And if you don't actually say, look, you guys need to work together or you can't work here anymore because you're not trying to actively
right.
solve the issue, then, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's an interesting request. The mediation is intended to, I mean, they want you to be there, because then how, if you don't want to be there, how open-minded are you going to be to the conversation? That's the premise. But that's an interesting point. My understanding was simply, you know, the only way they could force you is if you did it voluntarily or it was a performance issue. Beyond that, I'm not sure how you work. If it's something that's significant, if you take it to their dean.
I did several times, and they were the ones who came back from the provost who said, oh, you should do mediation. You should do mediation.
Should is different than must.
No, they said, go start this process. And we both met with the mediation person. The person never actually turned in their paperwork to go forward on it.
The mediation person did not?
No. The other person that was supposed to enter mediation decided not to, so the case got closed, and it delayed the whole thing a good 6 months, but nothing was done to actually take care of the issues there.
So one thing you might try is to suggest or request to the dean that they make it a part of the faculty workload, because that's a contract they sign with the faculty that says you will do these things in the coming year. And
that they don't hold.
Then they're evaluated against that. They're at the end of the year, they're evaluated against that workload.
I have not observed that in the time that I've been here.
I have. I've seen it work, and I've also seen it laughed at.
Yeah.
So it's the joys of working with faculty.
And I also think that we shouldn't discourage the grievance process. Specifically, most of the time when I've heard of this, HR tries to head it off and say, let's not have a grievance here, and I don't think that's beneficial. I think something needs to go down to indicate that there is an issue. And if there's a repeated issue with an individual, then there's only going to be one place that can actually be documented, and that's HR. So that's my other...
Yeah, the challenge with this is faculty and the different way that they are evaluated. And
it's not just faculty, though. I mean, it's any time that someone says, let's discourage a grievance, let's discourage someone pointing out an issue. And that's what I have a bigger issue with. Now, I had specific, you know, run-ins that, you know, made me unhappy in one way or another, but specifically here, I
have great concern about that, actually, if HR is discouraging a grievance.
I've heard things come back that said, HR said that this person would grieve. And, right, that's the problem I have with it. And it was as recent as within the past 2 months. So it's not like an issue that isn't there.
Well,
that's frustrating to me. I'd rather have something documented in the appropriate place.
So, Walker, I'm going to ask you to send me a write-up, a paragraph on this, and I will. You've added an item to my list, my conversation list with Brad Loveland, because honestly, the mediation program has evaporated, as far as I can tell. And so, one of my concerns as a supporter in launching that program was that HR pushed people to it. And then support them in a grievance. And not be grievance shy, risk averse, so to speak. So please, if you'll write that up and send it to me, I'll add it to my list to talk with Brad about.
Just if I might follow up on that comment, you said as far as you're concerned, the mediation program has evaporated.
You don't hear anything about it. They were supposed to. I know it's still there. Unless I've been removed from the mailing list, I haven't gotten an email about a mediation meeting.
And this is May Shock?
Yes,
no,
yeah,
okay.
So
how does somebody even request? They have to send her an email to request mediation?
It comes either directly from her or it comes from HR. And so those are the two places that are, she oversees the program. She knows who the trained mediators are on campus. And then if she gets a request, feels it's justified, and it's not, you know, she's, what her role there is, if you are racist, if you, you know.
Right, EO type
then
stuff.
If it's not something that she needs to act on, then she'll open a mediation. And so then she contacts the people on her list.
Well, I assume gets permission from the parties involved.
Right. Okay. Well, that's the mediator, too. The mediator sits down with them and explains the mediation process and the program and how, you know, you sign an agreement to mediate. Nothing goes in your file. Explains the whole process to them and attempts to gain their signature saying, yes, I'm here and I'm willing to do this. And then May actually steps out of it, depending on the case, the people involved, and who she selects as mediators.
It might be nice to ask May to come and talk about where mediation is right now, because there are a couple of things happening on campus. I know with the Justice Department thinking about a program that they're going to do, and I think she is thinking. I mean, she is doing things with the program, but it's happening very slowly. So it might just be nice to just get an update.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and I should clarify something with what she just said. You know, the Chancellor in a face-to-face with us and said that there was a line item in the budget request for the Justice Department to get a mediation center, kind of an alternative dispute center, and that might be a place to house the mediation program. And there was apparently some confusion related to that, potential confusion related to that. The mediation program still exists, and it is still under May. The other thing was a future maybe. Making that clear again since it came up. Any other questions? And reminder to Walker to go ahead and send me that. I'm sorry? Anybody? Okay, let's finish up. Staff Council blog update. Just a reminder that, again, to use that and send it far and wide. I will be updating it over break, you know, in my pajamas in front of the wood stove. So expect when we get back, we'll put out an announcement and encourage everyone to go to it. And there will be some more, Jerry, your comment earlier. There will be some more update or more information and data analysis coming from the staff survey that we did coming up on the blog.
I've had a number of questions on it. So.
Okay. And then the next item is PIPs, though we are a tad behind, and I want to ask everyone if you'd like to take a break or if you'd like to hear from PIPs first.
I vote for break.
Okay, we'll take a break then. For those online, PIPS is going to present, and as I understand it, did you distribute this PowerPoint to everyone? Okay, so PIPS is going to and talk on the PowerPoint that you've been sent. And we'll take a break, 5 minutes. We'll go ahead and come back from break, and I'm going to turn it over to PIPS.
Okay. So, the Staff Council Reorganization Group, Working Group, has been working over the last couple of months, and I wanted people to see who the members were. So there were, I think, about 12 of us, and not everybody has attended all the meetings, but we had a nice group. We had a significant group of people at every meeting, so I was just really impressed with the participation with this group and just wanted to thank everybody who worked on it. So for the background, we've had 7 meetings between October and December. We put together, Nicole put together packets for everybody that included the Constitution and bylaws, a 2009 staff survey that was done, the 2011-12 participation rates of both members and all, and we gathered some committee membership data, you know, who was actually, so we had numbers of who was coming to meetings, staff council meetings, and who was coming to committee membership meetings as well. So we compiled that for last year. Current membership numbers, Staff Alliance Work-Life Survey, the 2011 request for information that I sent out last year, just asking what staff council was doing well and maybe what we needed to improve upon. So we started with that as kind of our baseline numbers and baseline background information to kind of get everybody up to speed on all of the information that I felt was kind of pertinent to the issues that we were talking about. We also, Nicole collected some numbers data, who was specifically, how many rural reps we had is the way we do. So rural staff members that we had as defining people off of campus at UAS. Once we set a meeting going through all of the background information and talked and then gathered the list of our peer institutions that was identified from the accreditation process. So there were about a dozen peer institutions. We separated those. People took responsibility for researching each one of those and came back with information about how their staff councils were organized and how they were run, how many times they met, that kind of thing, to kind of give us other ideas about how we might address our own staff council. From that, we developed a big list of options, kind of went through a brainstorming period where we said, let's just put everything on the table, even if it sounds ridiculous. And that was kind of a fun process because there were some ridiculous things. But that was, that was the whole point, was to kind of get every option on the table so we didn't get partway through the process and realize, like, oh, we should have thought about this, but now we're, halfway through the process of refining things. So we're going to talk about all those possibilities for organization coming up. But just to let you know what the process is that we worked through, we discussed all the options. And we kind of narrowed it down. We took out the most ridiculous and then discussed in detail the other options. There were six options that we talked about, and we're going to get to that. But this is the process that we went through, discussed them, up with something that I think we're happy with. So this there's probably more goals than I've written here, but basically we wanted to restructure council for optimal success. And we realize that there are some things that are working well. So we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. We don't want to reorganize just for the sake of reorganization. But there are some things that we could probably improve upon. So trying to address the things that aren't working well, but keeping the things that are working well. I think after the first couple of meetings, we found that balance in our own conversations. So that was helpful. There were some struggles in the election process over the last couple of years that have been kind of more identified. So thinking about the election process and what happens when Walker, our beloved Walker, leaves, because he has such institutional knowledge and he's so good at getting this done, and it's a really important piece of our membership. If that doesn't run well, we're in big trouble. And so we're thinking about those issues as well, and I think our plan reflects that. One of the biggest problems that I think we have is the participation rate. And that's why last year we started kind of collecting more data on who's attending meetings, and not necessarily who specifically, but the rate of participation. And so we also wanted to talk about what we can do to improve participation, whether it's a negative thing or a positive thing, whether it's incentives or some kind of negative result. So we discussed those as well. And then we've talked about communication plans for a long time. So involved in this makeover is a communication plan as well. It's something that we've been discussing as long as I've been on council, and have I think found some things that work well, but not a way of really building it into the fabric of our organization yet. So that is another piece of what we're going to talk about. So. I think I'm still talking about this slide. So the results of our research were that there were six different ways that staff councils organized themselves. They're completely fully at large membership. Some people, some groups organize themselves based on employee classifications such as skilled, professional, clerical, technical, maintenance. Like our organization, some people were represented by unit representation. There was also at large by location. So, everybody in CLA would be represented by a group, but it was more by location, not by unit. So that was the distinction, unit versus at large. And then there's also the exempt, non-exempt classification distinction, and then some mixture of unit and at large, which kind of allowed for people to be representing units but also accepting membership from the general campus if there were people that, in addition to the members that were representing units, wanted to be involved. So there were positives and negatives to all of those, and we can go over those if people have questions, but I think immediately we got rid of the exempt, non-exempt, and realized that that probably wasn't going to work well for us, and we kind of had more detailed conversations about the other ones. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to other people on our team to kind of talk about what we are proposing for membership and
okay. So as Pip said, we did look at a lot of different types of membership, and we came up with two proposals. One was Plan 1, to retain our representative seats in unit, eliminate the alternate seats, because sometimes they don't get filled. I come a lot, but I don't see a lot of green. So to allow for proxies, if somebody can't make a meeting, they can arrange to have somebody come in their stead with all of their privileges, and add 5 to 10 at-large seats. The other plan that we talked quite a bit about was to organize membership by vice chancellor units, again, including the 5 to 10 at-large seats. And this would, the at-large seats would really help people who are really passionate about becoming involved, allow them to become involved regardless of their unit's participation already. Okay, go ahead and move on to the next. Oh, yes, question?
Quick question. The proxies is different than alternate.
Yes.
Meaning
yes.
You can sort of pick someone out of the air.
Exactly.
You come represent me today at staff council because I'm not going to be there. And, I mean, in a way it should be happening already, but it isn't. I mean, alts aren't always getting informed, and a lot of times alts aren't already there. So it gives the representative a lot more flexibility in being able to say, you're my designee today. There's an important vote. Here's what I want you to do for us. So,
and I guess, you know, as a comment based on the numbers that we saw for this election, I mean, I'm so pleased with, you know, the majority of seats anyway. It sounds like we're still missing six representatives out of 34, which is not insignificant. But it sounds like, you know, the ability to write in online really helps things, and so I'm really pleased with that. However, you know, 5 of 34 alt seats. Or 5 of 17 all seats right now are filled. So that doesn't work well for our current system. So this would hopefully increase the ability of somebody to show up if a member can't attend.
Now, there is one difference with a proxy and an alt, is an alt at least is already plugged in to getting the information, whereas if it's a proxy and somebody that had no familiarity with it, you know, you might get them interested in it, but
you're also assuming that all the alts are staying informed, which
well, I mean, they get all the information, the one direction, okay?
The processing.
I mean, at least they're plugged in. Is my point.
So one of the things, and let me make sure that it isn't a next slide thing.
Let you know what? Should we maybe go through the whole? Let's go through it once, and then we can take.
Yeah. Sorry.
So you want the next slide?
Yes. Any other questions?
Just vice chancellor units. How many units are we talking about?
There are 5 units, and the numbers range from like 200 to 800 per unit.
Okay.
And I just want to make a kind of a general comment. We both, I think the group as a whole was happy about either of these options, but we wanted to bring it to the general body now and get your guidance on what you'd like to do. As a body, do we want to move forward on one of these or not? And so rather than making a decision and narrowing it down kind of like without feeling really strongly about one or the other, we just felt it was kind of time to bring it to everybody. So
again, for the group's consideration, we did propose this committee structure after quite a bit of discussion. The elections committee would still be, is that EMR now? Okay. A committee for membership and rules, compensation and benefits, which would include health benefits, staff affairs, which would include grievance, evaluation, hiring, and other HR issues. Rural affairs will still be in, I guess, a separate committee. And advocacy, which would include onboarding, mentoring, communication, and public relations.
And just essentially here, we've taken the EMR and broken into two, elections and membership and rules, because they're kind of fundamentally different things.
Elections is a once, you know, a really heavy first semester
activity, and it's something that's super important and needs to be done well. So maybe a smaller committee that's working only on elections. So EMR was broken into those two groups. Current staff affairs was broken into two groups, again, because compensation and benefits, especially in the, you know, in the last few years, have been so significant that because we're not represented by a union, that becomes a significant issue for staff council. And it overshadows the other things that staff affairs should be working on, like grievance evaluation, hiring, and the other things that are written into our constitution and bylaws. And so the idea was that breaking those up into two pieces would allow everything to get done, and maybe, you know, smaller groups, that's fine. People who are passionate about compensation can continue with compensation, but it allows the other things that we should be kind of attending to stay on the table.
So there's one additional committee that we didn't have listed in the last slide. It mirrors what we currently have as an administrative committee, and that's the executive committee. What we were looking at doing is making sure that we got enough representation from all the groups reflecting the changes that we had done to the rest of the committee structures for proposal. So we'd have the president, the vice president, the past president, and then a committee chair from each of the different groups, so elections, membership and rules, compensation and benefits, staff affairs, rural affairs, and advocacy, for a total of 9 people to be making up this this executive board. And that will still be the place where agendas get set, but we're shooting for good communication the whole time. So this is very similar to what we had for our administrative board. We just renamed it and needed to modify to reflect the committees that we had. And then, do you have any other commentary on that?
No, I think nobody really liked the term administrative board. It didn't sound like that was something anybody was aspiring to be on. So executive board, we like the wording of that better, and kind of maybe summed up a little better what we kind of had in mind for that. But again, it's the same structure that we have now with just the addition of 2 committee chairs representing the split in staff affairs and the EMR.
And my next question on that is, are proxies allowed there?
I guess it's a detail that we have to talk about. Yeah, and we haven't talked about, you know, the details and the implementation. So again, before we get into, like, that's a good question, Richard, but before we get into all the little details, we wanted to kind of, you know, bring it to the body and see what people felt about it.
Okay, so after we had done all this discussion, looked at and talked to death all of the different options, we came back with several suggestions for things that we can change either way. The first one was related to incentivizing being on staff council, and one of the options for doing that is getting some sort of leadership training for those who wanted to participate, and it's good for the person who's doing it as well as during their participation in staff council. They get some direction on that. The other things that we wanted to more clearly do is make sure that reps and the representatives were clearly understanding what their role is here, so outlining their responsibilities and expectations. And part of that ties into the next 2 bullet points, spinning up a mentorship program that I believe it was that advocacy or staff affairs would be running, and then as well as an onboarding program so that we can get people coming into staff council, understanding what they need to know, what usually takes people 6 to 9 months to actually get up to speed on, making sure that they have someone to go to. So an onboarding program and mentorship kind of go hand in hand. We also discussed, and this is where kind of proxies really came into play, was consequences related to missing meetings. Right now, we have the ability for people to be excused from meetings. And some people are continuously excused from meetings. And what we were hoping to do was make sure that we put more teeth into it. It isn't always easy to determine who an alternate should have been there for. That is, if there are 3 alternates and 3 of them showed up, well, alternate one should be the person fulfilling the duty for them, for a missing representative, but they may or may not have showed up. So the benefit we saw there was adding the proxy to make sure that we had a way to remove those who really were not participating, who were not coming, who were not being involved. So. And then we had some further discussion related to committee meetings as well. That is to say,
there have been times where committees couldn't get enough work done because they didn't have enough people actually participating during the meeting time, so you couldn't establish a quorum. We don't want that. We want people who are here because they want to actually go through and do positive things, and if people can't make time for it, well, then that shows their priority is somewhere else. The last thing we got from an idea related to another university that we were investigating, seeing what they were doing. They have fundraising events, and the one specific one, I believe, held like an annual ball for doing a scholarship. And we thought it would be a positive idea to be able to do fundraising and then maybe actually be able to accomplish more within our body because we have a more significant budget. Right now, I believe we are kind of in a situation where we're relying on an allocation from the chancellor, correct me if I'm wrong, Joelle, then, and if we don't get a significant allocation, we can't necessarily bring people on site from rural campuses. We can't pay people to come in and do some sort of specialized training. We're much more limited if we don't have those resources. So these were the different actions that we may want to consider going and taking, whether or not any other big changes happen. And that's my piece. So I'll turn it back to each of you.
So that's our presentation to you, and we'd be open to questions and comments and leaving it up to the group to decide where we want to go on this now. And I guess another thing that Joella had suggested at some point was, you know, we haven't presented this as a whole package deal, obviously, because we have two options on the table for membership right now. So if there are pieces that sound good that we want to adopt, that's, you know, I think our committee's open to that. It was a really interesting process to go through because people, over the course of these 2 months, people really, including myself, you know, went from thinking, okay, we need a radical change to like, okay, no, most things are working okay, to back to like, no, we need a radical change. So, and we didn't all do that at the same time, you know, like sometimes I'd be advocating for, hey, we don't really need all this, you know, and other people would say, no, things aren't working well at all, and then we kind of shift. So it took us a few meetings to kind of just kind of get together, kind of coalesce as a group, I think. And in the end, I think everybody on the group that has been working feels good about what we've put in front of you. So we're all happy to take questions. Some people online too, there are, you know, many of us on the group. So.
I like the part having proxies, you know, be able to join in because it gives an opportunity to some people who don't want to make that true commitment, but they want to kind of see what's going on. And so if they do attend, you know, say in my place, then maybe they're going to see what the commitment is and how long it takes, and so they may get more, you know, they might buy into being a member the next time around that elections are held. So I think that kind of opens that up for folks. And we don't have an alternate, you know, for our group now, and that was one of the discussions I had with the two new representatives that they had. It was first is what's the time commitment, because it's kind of overbearing sometimes to think, you know, you've got to come to this meeting or maybe a committee meeting, and then how many days are you away from work, and different people have you know, different job tasks, you know, to finish up. So I think that works well in the favor of attendance for sure, and possible, you know, newer representatives in the future.
Well, we like that option too, and I think Gary's brought up some good points that we can, you know, we can think of ways of, you know, bringing proxies in. It makes that personal connection that you might have with somebody in your unit to say, you know, you seem interested, and I think you do a good job. You know, here, let me forward everything that I have to you if you're interested in being a proxy this year. I mean, we could set something up that maybe is a little bit more, you know, pulling that person into the fold a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good...
Can be a way to do it, but it's just...
Yeah.
Just
something good to think
more,
about.
More detail issues.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have one question.
Sure.
Would the at-large seats just be able to be open to people who want to join, period, or would they also have to be somehow elected into their at-large seat?
Yeah, they would be elected, and one of the things that we kind of liked about this was that if there were people that felt really passionate about joining and they only had two seats in their unit, it would still allow them to get involved, so we're not taking out somebody who's maybe very passionate about something. But also, one of the suggestions was to
run the member or the representative elections 1 year. So all this is just a suggestion. All representatives would get elected 1 year, and then all the at-large seats the opposite the next year. And so it rather than having to explain if you're an odd or an even unit and whether you can vote that year or not, you vote every year. Everybody, all staff members would vote every year. Perhaps they vote for members for reps the first year and then at large the second year. So we'd have a big turnover 1 year, a smaller turnover the next year. But it would again serve to make voting and the whole election process a little bit easier, I think, and maybe Walker can talk about this further. But we've had some pretty significant problems with elections the last couple of years, and I'm worried that with Walker leaving, if there's things that we can do now to streamline the process and institutionalize it, make it more sustainable and carry on, that we kind of think about that. So. Because somebody's going to have to be stepping into that seat next year, and it's a really important role to fill.
Related to elections, another thing that came up was that there's no reason that we shouldn't run them every year to make sure. There's no reason we shouldn't run them every year so that if there are empty representative seats, then they can't be filled during that process instead of the behind-the-scenes handshake that kind of occurs right now that says, oh, yeah, just come on up. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that because we're getting people to participate, but if we formalize it so that every year, if there are open seats, then those specific units are going to be able to vote, then that's, I think, a positive thing.
So if someone were elected, I mean, would we still be talking about two-year terms, or would we be, so if we're still talking about two-year terms, then if someone is elected during a year and, the next year, how are we going to be tracking that? And wouldn't that make it more complicated to try and figure out, who's running when?
I think that would be fairly easy, especially if we're still rotating between the main election times for representatives that are by unit and another year that's representatives by the other. I mean, one of them is going to be the major election year and just a minor addition for them.
Okay, so in the interest of time and our agenda, what I'm proposing here, what I'm going to do today is this is their presentation to you. This is for your consideration and thought. Over the next month, even those who are stepping down from council, I encourage you to make comments and recommendations and suggestions to PIPS, and she'll come back in for the January meeting with perhaps a set of motions for your consideration to spur action. So I encourage you to consider the next 30 days a comment period, and then we will, and maybe, trust me, maybe one of the actions is to table the whole thing. I'm just saying that she will come back with a list of possible actions, and we will act on their research. So that we can move on to the next items, I'm going to declare basically to the next meeting comment period to PIPS, and then we'll go from there.
Can I just request you collected a bunch of data on attendance and such like that. If that could be made available to us, I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Yep.
Certainly for me.
Yeah, let me, we have a Google site.
Okay.
With all documents on it, so let me just look at that, and then maybe the easiest thing would be to ask Nicole to invite staff council members
okay.
to the Google site, which is where all the information is.
Okay, and just the other thing is on timeline, if we're going to be changing this, then we're really looking 2 years down the line.
Something to discuss.
Okay.
It's all. I mean, we're presenting our big ideas about what.
Yeah, because we've just certified for people for the next 2 years.
Yeah, we wouldn't kick anybody out of the seat,
And it may be what I would ask then is that the group put together a suggested timeline. If, for example, come January meeting, council accepts the proposal in whole, what's your timeline for implementation?
Well, I'd like to know what the council was going to recommend before we put a lot more time into
a timeline. I mean, I don't think
that. I think some of the details about implementation are going to be based on what this group would like to do. I'd like feedback before we put a lot of time into. Nobody's wanting to say, okay, well, we have to change, we're changing our membership, so now you're not a member anymore. So in my mind, we would not be kicking anybody out of the seat. So whatever coincides with that, you know, mm-hmm. like Gary said.
With the number of alts that we currently have, we could put them directly into the at-large seat if that was a concern of losing someone during the time period. My point is there are ways to transition, and you have to determine how it's going to be as opposed to any big...
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to close discussion on this then, and we'll hear some more. And I encourage you to provide input to PIPS as chair of the group.
And I thank them for all their work.
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much.
A lot of work went behind it, I can tell.
Much appreciated, that's for sure. Next item is 7, the Carolyn Sampson Memorial Scholarship. This is mostly a historical thing. We, in the past... as a part of Staff Appreciation Day, we did a raffle, and we raffled off items. We went out into the community and got items as prizes, and we raffled them off, and that money went into this fund. And then once we reached a critical mass with the fund, they said we didn't have to do that fundraising anymore. This is a Carolyn Sampson Memorial. I apologize, I don't recall the history behind this individual, but it was a staff council-initiated fund. And my question to Nicole has been, what goes on with it? What's the process? We should at least hear from the recipients of the scholarship. And so on, and so this is just an information piece for you all. We will delve into the history and the process a little deeper and have something more for you in January, for example, description and so on. But that's what this item, why this item is on the agenda. If there aren't any comments, we'll move on to item 9. For the record, the Communications Committee was a temporary one-year committee. With the November meeting, it dissolved. And we are recognizing that the mission of the Communications Committee has always been a part of the mission of the Advocacy Committee, and it remains so. So we, at this point, have chosen not to do anything more with the Communications Committee and so on because we're waiting to see the reorg and how it may go. But that's just a matter of the record. That's why it's no longer on the agenda. Nicole's advocacy committee has not met. Nicole, I'm actually everyone unless
yes.
I'm going to go item by item. So item 9, I'm going to ask the individuals present, do you have any statements you wish to make regarding your items on under item 9?
Sure.
So 9. Go ahead, Nicole.
Okay, we're on advocacy.
Yes.
Sorry. They have not met. I am sending out a doodle today to kind of formulate who's going to be on the committee and possibly send it out to all council to see if anybody else is interested in being on advocacy, because I'd really like to start brainstorming the concepts of, you know, developing a mentoring program within council and improving onboarding and touching on the things that we kind of decided to discuss during the reorganization. That's kind of where it is at the moment.
All right. Thank you. Walker?
My report is attached. It's nothing spectacular. It's related to the elections mainly.
It has a big gold.
Yes, very
nice. Brad?
Rural Affairs didn't meet this month. It's my fault for not getting that meeting organized. We will meet in January. And the only thing I think I report preamble is that in January, I and the next committee chair will be meeting with the CRCD directors to promote staff council to them, talk about staff council, and ask that they promote it to their staff to encourage them to attend.
Excellent. Thank you.
We had some feedback to the reorg groups that staff affairs and rural affairs were going to work closely together, kind of had a tentative plan to overlap, and we all thought on our group, you know, we were kind of thinking about different ways to tackle that, and we were very supportive of that idea of whatever worked for your groups coming together to meet concurrently sometimes.
And that might be something that you look at making a bylaw amendment to the bylaws.
It sounds like, from what I read from staff affairs report, that both groups had the same response. We didn't want to merge groups, mm-hmm. but we all agreed that some cross meetings and more cross attendance between members would be a positive change.
And that was really well received at the reorg group, and I think Mary Alice brought that back at some point. So
yeah.
Sounds like one of the same features.
All right, staff affairs. Mary Alice is in excused absence, but she has an attached committee report. External statewide committee reports, the Staff Alliance Staff Healthcare Committee, Gary and Debbie are our representatives. I see Gary has a write-up attachment file.
There was another one that got sent out yesterday, and I don't know if folks had a chance to look at that.
I had Nicole hold on to it because it hadn't been approved yet, so I wasn't really sure what the
feature
was there.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, my view would be get it out because even if it hasn't been approved, it's timely. We've talked about some of the items. One of the things that I'm trying to wrap my head around is that we have all these RFPs out or not yet out for different elements of the plan. So I kind of asked for a timeline for what's out there now and what hasn't gone out. There's bunch of different ones for the basic medical plan. Then there's a vision one, and we recommended that we stay with the vision plan we have. And then they're trying to figure out how to rename the plan. Spend an awful lot of time. Names are apparently very important. For the two plans that we will have remaining, because they're getting rid of the old 500 plan because there's very few people on it, and they're moving orthodontia over to the 750 plan, which now becomes the more Cadillac plan, which is the one everybody was on previously, pretty much. And so many people migrated to the high deductible HDHP, and everyone found that kind of a tongue twister just to get that right. So they're call that the 1250 plan. But then there's another wrinkle in there to allow addition of health savings accounts, and you'll have to read up on that. I'm not going to hold forth on that one right now. But a high deductible plan plus a health savings account, then so they want to have a different name for that. So we still end up with three plans, but just increasing deductibles and with the health savings on top of that. So
okay,
I think we should, if we get the memo out, I think that'll help.
I think
people
we
to grasp
late,
it.
Late yesterday, Melody, there was consensus by SHCC that those minutes were approved.
Okay, I didn't see that.
It was really late. And I think I forwarded that approval to you. So she'll distribute out the staff healthcare committee meetings. The challenge with this is that, again, what's come from the president's office is misinformation, and the minutes go out to you all, to the committee members, to make sure that everybody, that we got it right, that nothing was missed and so on, because, again, these will be distributed out. So I urge some caution. I understand, especially when the meetings are so close, like your meeting. So when the meetings are close, it's going to be a challenge. And I prefer to err on the side of caution, so that we don't get the wrong information out.
And I have no problem putting drafts on it because that's true. It's not been approved or not approved.
Right, that's an idea too. Any questions then for your staff healthcare committee reps?
No, but thank you.
And the Staff Alliance Compensation Committee, we also met yesterday. They are moving forward on their proposals. And I've indicated in the past that I will run those through staff affairs, and then formally, though, they will go to Staff Alliance. And my timeline for those is in January, we will finish up the rest of the proposals and approve them. February, Staff Alliance will approve them, and then what we'll do is do a survey. We will conduct another employee survey on those proposed, and the items that we're looking at, for example, are geographic differential, changes in the intervals for leave accrual, changes for some of the requirements, for example, for FEMLA, recognizing a maternity leave as a qualifying condition for the donation, the sick leave bank, and so on. So there's a lot of different things that we're chewing on, but we will have hopefully a half a dozen or more specific proposals for your review, and then also for comments by staff. What my goal is to get feedback from staff at large, our 2,700 people that we represent, Staff Alliance represents, in time for our March retreat, and at the March retreat have the administration there and prepared to answer specific questions on, and then we can go forward. The next item, 11, and the various external committee reports, they are, come to us in written format. We do, however, have a couple of things that I will notify you now. The seats open on 11B, the Parking Advisory Committee, as of January 1. It's also open, H, to the Technology Advisory Board seat is open as of January 1. And then the Work-Life Balance Committee, although albeit inactive, it is something that the Chancellor inquired about during pre-staff, so it may become active. So I consider that a vacant seat as of January 1. And the Intercollegiate Athletic Council, Debbie Coxon is on that, but Britton is not. So what I'd like to do is I'm making you aware of these changes, and for the January meeting, we will seek membership. During the January meeting, we will seek replacements. And
well, I have a quick question.
Yes.
I know we had a discussion related to TAB and it having two spots for staff council.
Yes.
Did we ever get clarification?
No, I don't think we did. No.
Anyway,
well, actually, did we task you with that?
No.
We'll follow up.
Okay. And Gary, although we've only been sending one person, on the TAB website, it said for quite some time two staff council representatives, which I think they got from when two designations from staff council. So that's
yeah.
The other person that's been fulfilling that role was from what group was it? Vice Chancellor of
probably academic.
Okay. Well, the provost had offered one staff member through their end, I thought.
We'll get to the bottom.
Anyway, you'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll get to the bottom of it, and that seat, you'll know by for the January agenda whether or not the seats are open and if you have an interest in any of them. The ad hoc committee reports, the staff counselor calendar committee, Brad?
We are doing final proofing on the calendar. I'm hoping that we'll be able to say that there are, we found no typos and everything's ready to go, so we can send it off to printing. I think, I didn't look at our dates last year, but I don't think we're going to be any earlier than we were last year. We'll see a calendar in January. So when you get questions about it from staff, let them know it is coming. It'll probably be sometime in January, hopefully earlier than mid. It is Kurt Byers from SFOS.
And where is it? Where is
it's Dutch Harbor.
That's really pretty. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you, Brad, and thank you to your committee. We look forward to, in January, getting them out.
And we kept the January month on there. Now I'm wrestling with what the Chancellor was saying, is we're going to do that other day in there, which is, mm-hmm. since they won't know until February, we won't hold the calendar up.
No, right.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't think about it. I didn't notice it when I was looking at the holiday dates. I'll have to take a look mm-hmm. again. Uh-huh. Didn't even realize.
Okay, Ashley, do you have anything on staff? Oh, I see now that it has not met yet.
Right. We have not met. We're waiting on some quotes from catering before our next meeting.
Okay.
Ashley, do you know when the date might be for Staff Appreciation Day?
Yes, the date is set, I want to say February. May 15th. Just let me check my calendar real quick.
It's on your calendar.
Oh, it's not even on mine. May 15th, I'm 90% sure.
Okay.
And I have one comment for Brad on the calendar. Brad, I work in a very small department. It's me and only me, and I very rarely get things. So either in the January meeting, depending on if the calendar has been produced then, or the February meeting, can you bring some extra calendars to staff council for those people that don't get one?
We will.
Yeah, that's... You should get one, so we'll figure it out. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so the last item on our agenda is roundtable. Given that we are several minutes past the end date, I'd like to bypass roundtable today. Unless there is anyone that specifically wishes to comment, I'd like to bypass roundtable.
This is Evelyn from the Cusco Quim campus. I would just like it noted that I will be out for the month of January on medical leave.
Oh, all right, we wish you the best, Evelyn.
Thank you.
And And then, everyone, I wish you a happy holidays. Enjoy your break. Stay warm, stay safe, and embrace your family. If there is, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second.
All right. Thanks, everyone.